Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to Bugle episode 122, sub-episode beta. I'm Andy Zaltzman. I will brook no argument about that. Mr. John Oliver is still on holiday, and I am still trying to remember how to do stand-up comedy before going up to the Edinburgh Festival. But there are just 3 weeks to go until the real Bugle is back and life can once again have meaning, purpose and beauty. But in the meantime, you'll have to put up with this. The official Bugle History of the World, 2007 to 2009, Part 2, July to December 2008. And in July 2008, your buddies, our buddies, everyone's best buddies, the G8 held... Wait, can you guess what they held? Can you guess the G8? Go on, take a punt. Yes, it was a summit. And they both discussed and ate lots of food.
The G8 have held another summit, this time in Japan, and they convened this summit like they convene all of their meetings by projecting the silhouette of a chaffinch into the night sky and dropping what they're doing to run and combine the 8 pieces of a single magic amulet, which they each wear on a chain around their neck. I'm pretty sure that's how they call it, Andy. I can't fathom how else they can organise something with such huge logistical problems. That's the only way you could do
and
it.
And at such short notice as well. Well,
exactly. So is the world sorted out now? Is everything going to be fine? Well, yes and no, in that yes, it is not sorted out, and no, it isn't going to be fine. But at least the summit did go off without any horrible camera-catching protesting, and they achieved this through 21,000 police officers, Andy, at a cost of $280 million, with the result of 2 arrests. That is $140 million per arrest. They'd better make those charges stick. And to both of them. You don't want to put all that money onto one conviction. You're entering OJ territory there.
But it turns out that the G8s have been a bit naughty with fulfilling their aid pledges that they made at Glen Eagles 3 years ago, John. It's not so much the actual aid, but the pledging that counts. You know, right. It's really the thought that's the most important thing there. And as long as Africa knows that we mean to give a shit, it doesn't really matter to them that we don't actually give a shit.
Yeah.
And we Brits, we're one of the few countries that have fulfilled our promises. So I think it is probably time for us to have another go at the empire.
Yeah.
That seems only fair.
Well, that's just maths.
But, yeah.
Let's take a look quickly at what the summit actually did achieve. They announced plans to halve global emissions by 2050. I mean, that actually sounds pretty good. But you're right, again, because what we need to be careful here. These plans of theirs can be very much like the plans of a 10-year-old. Oh, I'm planning to be an astronaut. Then I plan to win the Super Bowl. And then I plan to eat all the ice cream in the world. When you know there's no way that lazy little shit is going to get off his 10-year-old arse and bother achieving even one of those. And the summit ended with a shared vision on climate change. But what was that vision, Andy? Was it a vision of men in suits staring awkwardly at their shoes and mumbling something about polar bears? And this shared vision involved absolutely no concrete plan of agreement over action whatsoever, merely an acknowledgement that they all agreed that there was a problem with climate change. It's like a group of vets standing over a badger they've just run over in their van and agreeing that, yes, he had been run over, and that, yes, someone should definitely do something about this before calling a press conference to excitedly announce how they all concur on the seriousness of the badger situation, as in the background, the badger dies.
G8 also discussed rising food prices, which are, of course, affecting all of us across the world in different ways. Some of us are having to spend a little bit more on groceries and a little bit less on the luxuries of life, like plasma screen televisions. And I mean the real ones, John, with human plasma. To get a better quality of picture.
It's also crystal clear.
Also useful in emergencies, you know.
They're not cheap, but they'll come down in price as they get more popular.
They will. Gordon Brown has made a controversial claim that we shouldn't waste food. He said that wasted food costs the average family £420 extra a year. And really, he's right, it is the government's job to decide how much money families should have to spend extra a year without really noticing. That's a basic tenet of modern democracy. But my grandparents lived through rationing in the war.
Yeah, just.
And they saw off the Nazis by eating...
Hold on, not single-handedly. That's a hell of a claim, Andy.
Well,
Grandpa and Granny Zaltzman.
I did their bit. They saw off the Nazis by eating powdered eggs and badger nuggets. It seems the very least I can do to honour our greatest generation by buying more than I need and chucking it away because I feel like a takeaway. Otherwise, John, we might as well dig Hitler up, gaffer tape him to Big Ben and tattoo a swastika on the Queen's arse.
Not only did you say that we should stop wasting food, he also announced that the government will be urging supermarkets to drop their 3-for-2 offers, which encourage overconsumption and wastage. All fair and important points, Andy, but somewhat diluted by the news that the G8 leaders had sat down that night to an 18-course meal washed down with wines flown in from Europe and the US. It's like the old saying, Andy, don't lecture people about over-consuming food and then go have a 19-course dinner. And of course, they didn't do that. What they did have, though, was an 18-course dinner. And maybe they could have shaved a few courses off that just for the sake of the moral high ground. Obviously, they need to eat. I know that. Could they not have stopped at a massive 9 courses? Just try and keep it under double figures. I mean, I'm scanning the menu now. Maybe lose the hairy crab bisque soup, because they've already had the boiled clam tomato and shiso in jellied clam soup. You know, you've had a soup.
These guys need all the brain food they can get. And, you know, eating food like this, that kind of provokes a kind of sideways thought. And, you know, they have kind of different interesting combinations of foods. And maybe that helps their political thought, having, you know, different interesting combinations of policies. And no. So they have to keep having more and more courses until they get the solution.
You're only saying that because you would like to have had some of that dinner.
I would like to have had that dinner.
You know, they could have... You're saying that they shouldn't have held off on the milk-fed lamb flavoured with herbs and mustard, because just 6 courses ago, they'd had the roast lamb with black truffle. And they, at that point, were starting to take the piss.
I agree, it can appear insensitive to eat an 18-course meal while there are literally millions and millions and millions of people starving to death in the world. I think, at the very least, they should have had some of those courses served by airdrop. It would have looked like they cared if they'd had their confused lobster meringue with an aggression of caviar served on a 10-poster bed of triffid petals. If it had been served by being dumped out the back of a remote-controlled model aeroplane. It's all about PR.
At least they made these pronouncements before dinner and not during it. And I do think that was wise. There's no doubt that, as a whole, the summit was disappointing, occasionally pathetic and instantly forgettable. But there was a staggering moment at the end. At least an incredible anecdote was provided from this, and that Bush apparently surprised the other world leaders at the end of this summit during a private meeting by closing out that private meeting with the words, and this is true, "Goodbye then from the world's biggest polluter." He then punched the air while grinning widely as the rest of those present, including Gordon Brown and Sarkozy, looked on in shock.
Fast forward a bit to a slightly later bit of July 2008. You're out beard spotting in Belgrade. You see an absolute corker of a beard. You're about to go up to ask its owner if you can paint it when all of a sudden he's arrested and packed off to face a war crimes trial. You pack your easel and grey paints away and console your own disappointment with the knowledge that at least Radovan Karadzic, 10-time winner of Naughty Serbian magazine's prestigious Rogue of the Year award, had at last been captured.
There was big news from the old world this week when it was revealed that ex-Bosnian Serb leader and warlord Radovan Karadzic had been captured. And warlord has to be one of the coolest, albeit morally reprehensible-sounding job titles available. Either that or warlock. I think I wanted to be a warlock when I was a little, Andy, until I realised the amount of paperwork that was involved. I just love the idea of riding a pitchfork.
You were a pretty good warlord in your time back in Britain before you were hounded out of the country.
Yeah, that's a part of my life that I don't like to dwell upon now, Andy. I did what I did. Do you regret, Rhiann?
All I can say is the streets of South London are a lot more relaxed since you left.
Yeah, relaxed, but a little more unruly. I ruled with an iron foot. So, Karadzic was the most wanted war criminal in Europe and was responsible for tens of thousands of deaths and has been on the run for 13 years. Now, Richard Holbrooke, the US diplomat, tried to explain his significance as a figure to Americans by saying, "This is a historic day. One of the worst men in the world, the Osama bin Laden of Europe, has finally been captured." Here's the thing, Holbrooke. I think you'll find that bin Laden is the Osama bin Laden of Europe. He's pretty much the bin Laden of everywhere. When you've committed terror attacks on that scale, I think you have earned the right to be the touchstone by which other arseholes are judged.
Holbrooke also described Karadzic as a major thug. It does seem that the Hague War Crimes Tribunal might rule that to be something of an understatement.
So where has this internationally renowned douchebag been hiding all this time, Andy? It must be somewhere pretty impressive to have evaded capture for over a decade. Was it in a cave? An underground bunker, maybe inside an invisibility cloak. No, none of those. Instead, this modern-day Scarlet Pimpernel chose the master disguise of becoming a bearded New Age doctor and practising medicine under a false name in Belgrade. That was it. His plan to avoid capture was just to grow a beard and hope for the best. Come on, that's not even Scooby-Doo standard. When they caught him, he was heard to be screaming, I would have got away with it too if it wasn't for that pesky war crimes tribunal.
Yeah, Karadzic apparently has become a self-proclaimed expert in human quantum energy, which is a bit of a sideways career move from genocide. Maybe he's learnt his lesson. But perhaps that means he would have liked to use the quantum energy power chip golf glove, which, according to its own website, can really improve your driving as well as your short game and your ability to order ethnic cleansing.
It does seem, from Karadzic's example, that there is no better place to hide than directly under the nose of the authorities dressed up like an off-duty Santa Claus. So, since 95, he's been renting an apartment in Belgrade and using the name Dragan Dabic. And he's been making a living practising alternative medicine. And pretty alternative, seeing as his specialist area was mass genocide. You just don't get that in mainstream medicine, Andy.
This is very good news, basically, unless, I guess, you're a Serbian nationalist musical writer. And you were just putting the finishing touches to the score for your hit new stage show, Radovan, What a Man. In which case, I guess you'd be pretty pissed off and have to write a new ending. But for everyone else in the world, it is the good news. And he's apparently going to defend himself.
Good idea.
Because I think what history shows us is that there's one thing that genocidal despots generally don't lack, and that is self-confidence. Arguably, they have it to excess, and this is part of the problem. But always entertaining. You stick a despot on a witness stand, and the fireworks will flow.
Well, he's great at disguise. Perhaps this is his escape plan. He's just going to put on a false moustache and glasses and then just walk free out of the courtroom.
His capture's been linked to the new Serbian government, which took power a couple of weeks ago, and apparently wants to get a place in the EU. And it just shows what an incredibly powerful continent Europe is, John.
Yes.
That when a membership of EU is up for grabs, then basically anything goes. And I think maybe, looking at this, if we really want a peaceful world, we should offer Al-Qaeda a place in the European Union. Because I reckon if we did, they'd probably have Bin Laden in the post by sundown if they thought they could get some decent agricultural subsidies out of us.
Either that, or if we learn one thing from this, is that if we want to find Bin Laden, we should start checking acupuncturists in the Washington, D.C. area. It's possible that he's been selling aromatherapy candles for the last year out of his own shop in Philly.
Karadzic's lawyer expressed disappointment and complaint about the way in which his client was arrested. He said, people showed him a police badge and then he was taken to some place and kept in the room. And that is absolutely against the law, what they did. Now, it does seem a little bit petty, John, for someone who is basically going to spend the foreseeable future watching videos in The Hague and saying, yes, I suppose that is me and that one as well. It does seem a bit petty for someone who I guess most people would agree has really overstepped the mark legally with his mass killing foible, for then to turn around and have a go at the police on a matter of technical procedure. It just seems a little rich.
In all the wonderful details of this story, the one that trumps the whole bunch is the revelation that he also had a bi-monthly column in Healthy Life magazine. Let me run that by you again, as it can be difficult to take in the first time. A man charged with ethnic cleansing worked for Healthy Life magazine. Although, to be fair, they, as a publication, have always been a safe haven for despots. Idi Amin once had a column writing about earwax candles, and there is still a letters page to this day called Ask Mugabe.
Of course, in 2008, there was only one story on the world's lips, the Kennedy assassination. Oh, no, hang on, that was 1963. Anyway, in 2008, there were two stories on everyone's lips. One, Prime Minister Gordon Brown's continuing efforts to boil an egg just by looking at it. And two, the American election. And in August, it was convention season. And can you guess who was there? Barack Obama, for one of them anyway, and John Oliver, for both of them. First up, those Democrats and their ludicrous faux Greek temple.
I've been here the whole time, Andy, and let me tell you, the convention centre itself looks like what would happen if you got a six-year-old to design their own birthday party. I want a million balloons and TV screens all up the wall onto the ceiling, and I want donuts. Thousands upon thousands of donuts.
Well, they're good donuts, John. That's the key.
They were mini donuts, yeah. Andy. So it depends, really, whether size is important for you with your donut.
Well, it is important to me.
Or whether you prefer the small donut in higher quantities.
Well, I don't like donuts, so I like the small donut in small quantities. So it doesn't sound like it's the place for me, really.
I always found that strange that you weren't a big donut fan, Andy.
Why is that strange?
It's such an inoffensive snack, the donut.
Oh, Hitler liked donuts.
Really? Is that the only foodstuff that you know that Hitler enjoyed?
Yeah, it's all he ate. That's why he was so short. He didn't get all the vitamins he needed when he was growing up because he ate donuts.
And I think, as his actions showed, that man was over-sugared as well. In many ways, too much short-burn energy. Maybe Germany would have been a different country in the 30s if he had avoided the chocolate D.
Anyway, back to the convention, John.
Yeah.
Must have been quite an amazing thing to see.
It was incredible. I was actually on the floor of the Obama speech amongst the delegates, which was a place that somehow I had the credentials to be. And yet I think all around me would have agreed that there was a problem with the issuing of those credentials. It was quite a strange feeling being at a moment of genuine American history with the sole intention of finding a way to undermine it. It really was strange. It was like being at Gettysburg and taking a whoopee cushion with you. So at one point during the week, I found myself physically running after Jimmy Carter, trying to think of something ridiculous to say to him, if I could cut him off before he got behind a cinnamon stick stand. And that sticks with an X. And it was almost out-of-body experience as I ran towards the living president of the United States, getting ready to say something reprehensible.
Did you catch him?
I did catch him. Oh. Actually, Joe, I did catch him. That was a thing. And so I was ready to go. And then the cameraman's battery went down.
Yeah. So that's quite an awkward social situation, isn't it? When you've chased down a former president and then you've got nothing to say.
It was. I mean, he was looking at me very much with who the f*** are you in his eyes? And why are you standing in my way? But yeah, so sadly, Jimmy Carter and I only got to enjoy an awkward silence rather than an awkward conversation.
So what did you do to break that silence?
I think I said, "Sorry, Mr. President, the camera battery seems to have gone down." He didn't seem as disappointed with that as I was.
Right.
And so he simply continued on into the arena.
Where he fought a bear, barehanded.
That's right, that was what he was there for. It was Carter versus the bear. It was the 3 p.m. slot. He's done a lot of speeches in his time, Andy. Now he just likes to do bear fighting.
The real Jimmy Carter at last.
That's right, so he just did 20 minutes of that. Did pretty well.
What did you think of the stage at the stadium speech? The supposed Barackopolis, as it was described by Republicans.
It was a natural phenomenon, Andy. 10 columns rose overnight out of the stadium's floor. No one knows how they got there. No one knows when they're leaving. But it is one of the great natural phenomena of life. 10 Greek columns standing there. I mean, it was an incredibly arrogant move. Pretty much to say, I'm Zeus, this is Mount Olympus.
But
look on my democracy, ye mighty, and despair.
Well, that of course is how Stonehenge began. It was a political rally in the early 19th century.
Well, it's just a druid. Yeah. Like, yes, we can. Yes, we can what, druid? Yes, we can what? Yes, we can do spells.
But I heard that the Democrats actually toned it down a bit from their original plans. Because in rehearsal, I heard that Barack Obama came out carried by Persian slaves in a tunic, sacrificed a bull, and invoked the vengeance of Zeus in his feud with John McCain before declaring war on Sparta, stripping naked and wrestling a teenage boy. To get the full kind of Greek analogy going.
You never know. I think that might have won over some of the undecideds. I think it might have been a mistake just to go with words at the end. Now, you can dress it up how you like. It's still words coming out of a man's mouth.
Yeah.
Whereas, stripping naked and wrestling a boy.
The following week, it was the turn of John McCain and the Republicans to strut their funky action, and for Sarah Palin to attempt to hammer the final nail into the coffin of America's standing as a viable democracy.
I guess the story of the convention really is Sarah Palin, and it is really depressing that that's true. It's depressing that a move so cynical seems to have worked, because they went absolutely crazy the other night for her. They were walking out, all of them screaming, "Home run!" She knocked it out of the park. Another crass sporting event. Touchdown. It was a three-pointer. It was a long blue to the top left corner.
In fact, that's one for our British listeners. Think Alex Higgins in the 1982 World Semi-Final.
Oh, what a shot, Andy. What a shot.
So, John, I mean, have you met many average hockey moms in your time in America?
I don't know. I mean, that's very much the new thing to be now, to be a hockey mom, which is interesting in a country which has completely turned its back on that game. I guess I've probably met them all the time now, seeing as they've all reinvented themselves as hockey moms.
Right.
There's a certain kind of Stepford hockey mom here.
Because she did describe herself as just your average hockey mom. And now, call me old-fashioned, John. I know I'm not American and therefore don't really have a vote in this election, but...
Well, Andy, that, again, we're going back to whether you recognise American independence or not.
I guess so. To me, it sounds like the average hockey mom is, if not the last person that you would want to be one rogue snooker shot away from the Oval Office, then certainly probably the penultimate person you'd want to be that. They're just that sliced cue ball that jumps off the table and hits the president, you know, on the temple.
Is that the second snooker joke already?
Yeah, I know. We're going in hard. Well, it's just because, it's a convention special. That's 2 weeks we've had. Kind of aimed, I guess, not squarely at our global listeners, more at our American. So, a bit of snooker. It's the game that the rest of the world plays.
The incredible thing with Payne as well is the vetting process for her. Because gradually, each day, there's been a new, absolutely incredible fact emerging about her. One, that she was a member of this party, which was actually part of the Alaskan separatist movement. Which, I suppose, is... in many ways, quintessentially American to want to segregate from the nation. That's really taking it back to old school. But it does seem that... I mean, that's not even a vetting process that should have caught that. That's just a Google search. Well, I know that McCain doesn't use a computer and has talked a lot about that, but surely someone should have just put in Sarah Palin, enter, and seen what came up.
Yeah, but I guess if what came up was that photo of her in a Stars and Stripes bikini... holding a machine gun, then all other vets are off, shall we say. That's surely enough for any red-blooded American voter.
Actually, next week, Andy, I'm going to be doing the Bugle with a machine gun and a Stars and Stripes bikini.
I don't really approve of your increasingly cavalier attitude towards the Bugle dress code.
Cavalier? It's uniform, Andy.
And also, Sarah Palin, she only got her American passport in 2006... and has been to a total of 5 countries, one of which, it turns out, she went to only while her plane refuelled there.
You can't count that. You do not get, Andy, the flavour... I don't want to come across as a liberal hippie here. You don't get the flavour of a nation from its airport.
Oh, I don't know. When I was a kid, so I was flying to South Africa to see my grandparents, and, we stopped off in Mombasa in Kenya, and I like to think that ever since then... I've really had a deep spiritual affinity with the people of all parts of Africa as a result of that half an hour stopover at the age of 6. But it does show the same kind of level of curiosity about the outside world that has served George W. Bush so well as president. Never to have left America until she was, 45?
I think that just proves she's ready on day one, Andy. She's fit for office. She has a complete lack of interest in the rest of the planet. American voters respond to that.
Again, looking at it from a British perspective, they do love to drag their families into these political messes, don't they?
Oh, sure.
And I have to say, Bristol Palin's boyfriend looked like he was really starting to regret frung doobling with the governor's daughter. He had that look about him saying, well, I had a few things planned for this week and it wasn't standing up in front of the world's media looking right. Slightly guilty.
What's happening with young Levi is that... He is very much paying for that mistake. It really must be strange to be, just a classic irresponsible teen who is now being forced to stand in front of 20,000 hardline Republicans applauding his courage in knocking up his girlfriend.
Now, we all know how important it is to control the media, and it has been ever since Jesus had the Association of Professional Gospel Writers absolutely in his pocket. Man, did they talk that guy up. What was he paying them? Front row seats to his latest parable gig and a go on Mary Magdalene? I don't know. Anyway, in September of 2008, the Chinese state news agency showed just how keen they were to get a good scoop by scooping the scoop before it had actually happened.
China is in space. It launched a rocket containing astronauts. To attempt China's first ever spacewalk, the rocket Shenzhou 7 is supposed to be the first space rocket visible from the Great Wall of China. There was one fascinating story with this, John. The Chinese state news agency published a supposed conversation between the three astronauts on board this rocket, kind of describing what was going on the rocket and, you know, the trip so far. Unfortunately, they published this before the rocket had taken off. In another spectacular example of Chinese media management, shall we say, following on from the use of a pretty girl to mouth the Olympic anthem.
Well, yeah, there are two possible explanations for this, Andy. One, the Chinese government is so obsessed with controlling their public image that they faked a transcript and they mistakenly released it too soon. Or two, the Chinese government are so obsessed with controlling their public image, they've carefully scripted all conversations to be taking place in space. It's going to be like a play. The astronauts have been rehearsing for months. This is curtain up time.
Obviously, they're learning quite a lot from America, it seems. Of course, the real conversation on board was, in fact, much more mundane, as we now know. We do have a transcript of what that conversation was, and here it is. Nice takeoff, Wing Lao. Thanks, Li Chang. Anyone know how to land this thing? Just kidding, I'm fully trained. How's Mai Ling? Oh, she's okay. Oh, good. Why'd you ask? Oh, it's just, I heard you two were having a few... No, we've sorted that out. She's fine with me going into space now. Well, that's because it means you can't stop her from... nothing. Stop her from what, mate? Nothing. Hey, did you see the table tennis last night? Good game. What are you inferring, mate? Is she seeing that rocket scientist again? Is she? I'm a f***ing astronaut. What more does she want? Well, she probably wants someone who doesn't wear his f***ing space suit in bed. At least take the helmet off before you... You know. What? Is it a crime to love your job these days? No, but, you know, just keep them separate. Oh, con H. Fuchsius. That's really pissed me off. Hey, slow down, man. You're going to hit that satellite. What of it, mate? Hey, look, I'm sure you two can patch things up. I'll patch you up, mate. Calm down, Li Chang. Get your hands off my rocket. Ooh, ducky. I cannot believe you're on this mission.
In November, finally, after all the build-up, the American public went to the polls. And they were faced with a historic choice. Either the first black man ever to be president, or the first witch ever to be vice president. History, either way. But luckily, they chose the way the world had voted for Obama.
So, well, there's only one place to start this week, and what a moment for the world. John, a historic moment, a young, charismatic, eloquent, mixed-race man who's excited and inspired the world throughout the year, has broken through the barricades of history to become Formula One world champion.
No, Andy, no, that is not the top story.
Isn't it? I like sport.
That is not the top story.
Right, what is the top story then?
The top story this week is what else, Andy? USA! USA! Greatest country in the world, Andy. Greatest country in the world until the dust settles and the reality of the current situation starts to sink in. But no one's thinking about that now, and rightly so. Number one, baby! Woo!
So, well, it must have been pretty exciting to be in America for the election, John.
It was extremely exciting, Andy. Barack Obama, or to give him his full name, President Barack Obama, or to give him his middle name as well, President Barack, holy f***ing shit, I can't believe that this has actually happened, Obama, became the president-elect of the United States of America. And lo, just over half of the nation went batshit crazy. My only concern, Andy, is that America has experienced such incredible mood swings in the last year, and is set for a lot more before and then immediately after January the 20th. Most doctors would probably argue that America is currently at risk of becoming bipolar. This nation is exhibiting the classic behaviour of a manic depressive. The highs are incredibly high, such as Tuesday night, and the lows have been incredibly low, such as the last 8 years, with Michael Phelps thrown in there as well.
Well, John, it was a pretty decisive victory. It was a margin of defeat that even the Republicans couldn't win with. And, you know, when you look back now at the campaign, John, I think there's a number of turning points. And I think probably the key turning point was just towards the end of September when Obama was struggling a bit. And I did a gig for the Democrats Abroad organisation at the Soho Theatre in London.
Really?
In front of about 120 people. And if you think back to the end of September, McCain had about a 15 to 18 point lead in most polls, I think.
Well,
you know, let's say that he did. So I think my gig really, really swayed things.
Well, I mean, that can't just have been a coincidence.
No.
I mean, it could have been, but not really. Obama delivered his victory speech in Chicago's historic Grant Park to an adoring crowd, walking onto the stage with his ridiculously photogenic family. They're a good-looking bunch, the Obamas, Andy. I'm pretty sure there's a photographer's wall somewhere that they're supposed to be on. Every time you see them standing together, it's like they're painted in watercolour. There should be a still-life plant wilting lightly behind them, and maybe a naked 6-year-old retiree life model with his wang hanging out. Obama very impressively managed to resist the temptation to begin his speech with, OK, America, let me let you in on a secret. I am actually a Muslim, and I do hate America. Here's your new Secretary of State, Louis Farrakhan.
Well, that would have been a real showstopper. Literally, probably, a showstopper. I think the only thing he could have done to trump that was to admit that he had blacked up for the entire campaign, which I think would have punctured the enthusiasm a bit. But I guess his point would have been, judge me on my character.
It would have been a relief to about 49% of the country. This was a night that few people thought they'd live to see, including Obama himself, who said, I was never the likeliest candidate for this office. We didn't start with much money or many endorsements. And now look at him, Andy. He has spent more money on his campaign than any candidate in history, had almost every celebrity endorsement except for John Voight and Kelsey Grammer, and even had Oprah in the crowd in front of him standing in the cold. That was a moment that most people found almost more unbelievable than anything else. Really, Obama? You're making Oprah stand out in the cold. After all the money that she's given you, you can't even get the Queen of America a backstage pass. She should have had a throne right in front of the stage. For shame, Mr. President.
I'd like to see her as Secretary of State. She's someone who the world can relate to, who the world already respects and knows.
Yes.
And I just can't think of any better candidate.
There were many, many prominent African-American figures in the crowd, including a tearful Jesse Jackson, who was visibly overcome by the moment, but was also overheard muttering, the most incredible thing about tonight is I still want to cut his nuts off. What's wrong with me?
Jesse Jackson also said, now I can look my grandchildren in the eye and tell them that if they want to, they can be president too. And I thought this was slightly concerning for the world, John. I had no idea that Jesse Jackson actually wielded that much executive power. And, you know, it's a great moment in Democratic history, Obama's election, and straight away, Jackson is trying to hijack it for the benefit of his own grandchildren. Makes me sick.
Keep it in the family.
And the last time a president was accused of fathering black children, Thomas Jefferson, he kept pretty stum about it. And it's great to see that Obama has the confidence to parade his proudly around on world television. Shows how much America has changed in the last 200 years.
The most touching moment was perhaps when Obama spoke to his daughters, saying, Sasha and Malia, I love you more than you can imagine. And you have earned the new puppy that's coming with us to the White House. Fathers across the globe all instantly started feeling like bad parents. Because that is holding your children to a very high standard. You can have a puppy if and when you help get me elected president. Most parents give their kids puppies just for not drinking milk through their nose.
Obama winning the election, of course, meant far more than just one of the most important symbolic moments of social progress in human history. Arguably more importantly than that, it meant not much more of George W. Bush. And in December, one Iraqi journalist heroically took his chance to issue a physical footwear-based parting shot at the outgoing president.
Andy, sometimes it's impossible to know what will take the internet by storm. Will it be a hamster on a piano eating a piece of popcorn? Will it be a skateboarder suffering a spectacular nutshot from an unexpected piece of railing? Perhaps a teenage boy dancing awkwardly yet overconfidently to a sexually explicit rap song? Well, for this week only, Andy, it was none of those things. It was in fact simply a 62-year-old man having a pair of shoes thrown at him.
It's always this wasn't
exactly, but this wasn't any old man, Andy, and they weren't any old shoes. This was President George W. Bush being facially confronted at high velocity with the second most famous example of protest footwear in history, after when Judas threw his flip-flops at Jesus. Bush was on a surprise farewell trip to Iraq, the most spectacular since his surprise hello trip in 2003. During a press conference, an Iraqi journalist stood up and threw his shoes at him, shouting, this is a farewell kiss, you dog. This is from the widows, the orphans and those who were killed in Iraq. And it was probably not the Secret Service's finest hour. The man had time to take his shoe off, throw it at the president, bend down and take his other shoe off and throw that one at the president too before he was wrestled to the floor. In fact, He'd probably have had time to get a third shoe off, were it not for the fact that he was tragically born with less than 3 feet. But CNN were very anxious to tell people that, in the Arab world, throwing shoes at someone is thought to be a very great insult. Oh, no kidding, CNN. I think that most people got that from the shoes flying through the air towards his head. I don't think anyone imagined there was a possibility that this was in fact the highest form of compliment.
I don't know, John.
Thank you for our freedom, President Bush. Please, take my shoes. And if you'd be so kind, please, catch them with your face. I have nothing but the greatest respect for you.
Maybe he was thinking, you know, if I can get the president to sign my shoes on eBay, they're going to go. They're going to go big.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because the make of shoes themselves have since become immensely popular in Iraq, with many shops completely selling out of their stock. Was this, in fact, a very clever viral marketing campaign? Because those shoes have had better media coverage than the latest Air Jordans. Would it have been that surprising if, after the footage of the president ducking out of the way of the shoes, the screen had just gone blank, but for a Nike swoosh and the words, "Just do it." Air protest. Lightweight shoes which slip off quickly and easily for when you can feel yourself being watched by Secret Service agents. Ergonomically designed to fly through the air, increasing your distance and velocity for markedly better results. And complete with a patterned sole to leave a mark on your target's face.
Well, I think, John, I think we're being far too negative about this. It's well known that people throw knickers at rock stars. Clearly this guy's just a foot fetishist with a bit of a thing for the president.
That's a nice way of looking at it, Andy.
Also, he says, "This is a farewell kiss, you dog." And, you know, to be fair, he is a bad kisser whose shoe-hurling technique has not proved a massive hit with the lasses in Baghdad's nightclubs. I mean, it was a botched assassination attempt, essentially. Just very badly planned from start to finish.
Yeah.
Very few people have ever been killed by thrown shoes. But I think what was interesting about it was the outstanding technique in shoe avoidance that Bush showed. I mean, he just swerved out of the way of it. It was like a high-class opening batsman avoiding a bouncer on the first morning of a test match. It was like a young Michael Atherton. And this, to me, suggested that this has happened before, John. George W. Bush has avoided shoes thrown at his head probably throughout his life. He looked like it had happened all the time. He just kind of grinned at the guy and said, "Well, another shoe. Well, that's another one for the catalogue." Well, here's, in fact, a list of all the people who could have thrown a shoe at George W. Bush. Yeah. Actually, we're going to have to cut that out. We don't have time. I want to be back in home for the boy's first birthday. But but the point stands.
And that, friends, Romans Buglers, is that. Tune in, if indeed you can tune in to a podcast at the same time, or if you want a different time next week, or indeed in a subsequent week, that's the joy of podcasts, for part three. And remember, not long to go now until the showbiz event of the decade, the official world premiere of my Edinburgh show. Andy Zaltzman swears to tell the truth, half the truth, and everything but the truth. On the 6th of August, 4:20 p.m. at the Stand, and then every day until the 29th of August, except the 16th. Well, I mean, you didn't need me to tell you that, did you? Well, you didn't need me, or probably even want me to tell you that, but I have told you it, and that is now public domain, which it already was before. Anyway, I'll also be hosting Political Animal at the Stand, midnight Mondays to Thursdays, and I expect to see every single one of you there at every single one of the gigs. And in the meantime, you can keep bang up to date with everything that's not happening in the world on the Bugle Twitter feed, at Hello Buglers. Bye-bye. And bye-bye from John as well. He means it too, even if he hasn't actually said it. He means it from the very bottom of his heart. Bye-bye.